Hi, hello, welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by co-host Matt Oper. How's it going, Matt?
It is going spectacularly well, because the Bearcats are kicking ass. Even when they play badly, they're kicking ass. You know, it's the little things in life, like your basketball team being an unstoppable death machine. That's pretty cool.
Let's jump right in with the basketball talk. Since we last recorded the podcast, the Bearcats took down Connecticut on Saturday in kind of pretty much a blowout fashion. And then last night they beat the Central Florida Knights 60-50. A lot to be positive about, but as is our nature, there is some negativity surrounding the team. In neither game, they played particularly well. It could be February doldrums, but we're kind of getting to the point where the backcourt needs to start playing a lot better kind of quickly, especially with SMU on the horizon this weekend. Only one double-digit scoring game over the last two. If you go back to Tulsa, like only Kopay, well, all three of them, did pretty well in that game, but yeah, like not really anything from your guards the last two games. A lot from Kyle Washington, but then I don't know. The backcourt has left me a bit sour.
Yeah, and what's really strange about it is that Kevin Johnson and Troy Copain both started off conference play playing far better than they did in non-conference play. But that's kind of, they've regressed to the mean a little bit as the conference season has worn on. And I really don't think we should put too much stock into the UCF game, because playing a guy like Taco Fall is such a clear and obvious distortion of the offense. I mean, UC shot, I think it was 45% of their shots were threes. That is so far outside the norm for this team. That is not their statistical profile at all, but they really didn't want to challenge Fall inside. Everybody except for Kyle, that is. So they were far too eager to launch threes, regardless of situation, and that's really not where this team is the best at, especially when they're going isolation to get those looks. I mean, like, if the ball is popping and the moving and guys are moving into space, it's one thing. But if it's, you know, 1-2 dribble pull-up threes, yeah, unless it's Jacob Evans shooting that shot, I'm not comfortable with it at all.
Yeah, and even then, like, Evans has been on a bit of a cold streak lately. He did score 11 in the game last night. I guess on Wednesday night. So whenever I post this. But he did so on just 1-4 shooting from 3, which is not really great. Like, his numbers in particular have kind of taken a dive in conference play, and we keep, like, waiting for him to snap out of it, but so far, 11 league games, he's 14-45 from 3, 31%, only 44% from 2, and under 68% from the foul line, which are way down from his baseline numbers. Like, he's been almost average offensively, which is a pretty big regression from where he was non-conference. But it's almost the same thing we saw from him in conference games last year, where he had a very solid non-conference slate, and then conference play started, and his numbers dipped a lot.
Yeah, and it's, I think this is really a combination of a couple different factors. In conference play, obviously, I mean, this is a McTeam. The pace is going to slow way down. It's going to become more of a grinded-out style of offense. And as good a shooter as Jacob Evans is, he is not a good one-on-one player. Like, if you're just going to go ISO with Jacob Evans at the top of the key, it's not a good look for your offense, and it's not a good look for Jacob. I mean, it's just not, at this point in his career, that's not really something you can ask him to do with any consistency. Yeah, we talked about his struggles getting to the rim. You know, right now at this point, there's only two guys who can get to the rim whenever they want. That's Troy and that's Jerron Cumberland. Everybody else is, it's a struggle to get there. And because of that, efficiency numbers across the board are down in conference play. But that's not outside the norm. You know, that's kind of how these things go year after year. You expect conference numbers to be lower because the scouting's better. There's more familiarity. People know your tendencies. Just every team you play is going to be much more familiar with what you do and what you do well and badly, and is going to be more inclined to force you to do the things that you struggle to do. All that being said, I've still, you know, just like you, I've been kind of underwhelmed with his performance in conference play.
And to the point about Copain, besides late in the Tulsa game, he hasn't really been trying to get to the rim too much either. He's been really, like, kind of set on just taking long jump shots. Like 1 of 5 on 2s against UCF. But a lot of long pull-up jumpers, just 1 of 7 on 3s. Like, his three-point shooting was doing so well, and then the last three games he's 4 of 16. If you fold in the South Florida game, he's 4 of 19 from 3. Oh, that's free throws. Never mind. I don't know. I read the wrong line for one of these. Yeah, 4 of 19 from 3. That's not really great with how well he's been shooting before. He's still 37% on league play from the for the year, but I don't know, it's a bit concerning.
Yeah, but 2 weeks ago he was shooting 44% from 3 in conference play.
Very true, and UC is getting zoned a ton now, which is not really a big surprise. It's like UConn played a ton of zone against UC, and UCF plays, I think, mainly zone, because they can just funnel everything inside, and nobody wants to drive on Taco Fall.
Well, yeah, I mean, UCF plays a ton of zone because they can't risk having Taco Fall be put in the action because he's just, you know, he's got a lot of gifts defensively. Being put in the action is not an area where he's going to thrive.
Here's a stat. In the three games this February, guess how many times Copain, Evans, and Kevin Johnson have been to the line combined?
5?
9 times combined.
That's higher than I thought. Still terrible, but, you know.
But, like, all that being said, which is, like, not great, but then, like, you turn around and look like Kyle Washington, and he's been amazing. Like, almost the game of his life against UConn. Like, 27 points. Did pretty much anything he wanted, including shoot threes, which did kind of a lot early in the year. Like, I remember the Butler game especially, he was, like, three happy. Then he, like, holstered that for almost all of 2017, only to start busting him back out the last few games. And he's gone 5 of 10. And
you know what that suggests to me? It suggests to me that he was shooting them dreadfully in practice for most of December and January, and then he shot them well. So Mick's like, all right, you can shoot. If you give Kyle a green light, it's a green light.
And having the success he did against UConn, you don't want him to turn around and just stop against UCF. Especially when teams are just leaving him open at the top of the key. Just his favorite spot in probably his hot zone from 3. He's not really great from anywhere else, but like if you let him straight out, it's going to knock him down. At least come close to knocking him down. Like, his play has just been really great, and he's seen a lot of minutes, too. Like, 63 minutes the last two games after not even getting that the three games prior. So, like, being able to have him stay on the floor and rebound as well as he has, especially on the defensive end. Like, he's turning himself into, like, an all-conference selection. To the point where I think he's going to be the Bearcat on the all-conference team, for sure.
Yeah, because there's a dearth of forwards in this league. I mean, it's such a guard-heavy league and has been pretty much every year of its existence. Yeah, at this point, I mean, it's him and Lawson at the forwards. I really don't see much of a convincing argument for anyone else. The unspoken thing with Washington he is much, much better defensively than he was. That doesn't mean he's consistent play to play. I mean, he'll still space out and do some funky shit, but he's much more active, much more vocal, and he's become a real problem, you know, as a weak side shot blocker, because his athleticism is a problem at that spot. So, you know, UC really doesn't have anybody in the Taco Fall category where they're just going to park him at the front of the rim and deter shots that way. But they have two really, really good weak side shot blockers that are, you know, rim protectors in an unconventional way.
Yeah, outside of the Xavier game, he hadn't really done a ton consistently blocking shots. Like, he got four against X, and then he had a couple against UCF. Like, it was good to see that start springing back up. It's like, he is a pretty solid weak side shot blocker. And the thing everybody did, like Evans, Washington, Clark, all had multiple steals against poor Taco Fall. Turned the ball over six times. Then A.J. Davis turned the ball over four times. And out of 16 turnovers by UCF, UC had 12 steals, which is kind of insane.
Yeah, that's, you know, a good ratio is like, you know, 18% for a game. That was notably higher. Good God. Yeah, not to get too esoteric about this, but UCF ran the biggest pick and roll I've ever seen in my life with A.J. Davis and Taco Fall. That's 6'9 point guard and 7'6 screener. It was slow as hell, but it was really tall. And I think they got a bucket on it, too.
I think they did. Like, UCF, really, if they had, like, any wings who were any good, that they would be a tournament team for as well as they defend. Like, they can all, like, read KenPom and see, like, the stats. Like, when it actually plays out, they guard really hard. They really bought into a Johnny Dawkins system. And, like, their defensive numbers are really impressive. Like, their defensive efficiency league play is 96.1, which still only ranks fourth in the league because this league plays kind of insane defense.
And top to bottom, this is such a defense-heavy league.
And all the offenses are garbage. Like, UCF,
again, related factors.
UCF 16th ranked defense in the country, according to KenPom. And that game, we've talked about it pretty much all year. All 2017. That game in Orlando. That's where they play, right? Tampa? I don't know. Who cares?
The UCF is in Orlando. USF is in Tampa.
I just pissed off two fan bases in one misspoken sentence.
No, you didn't, because I, the geography nerd, two times Geography Bee champion, by the way, I corrected you, so we're not on the record being wrong.
Those are the takeaways of this podcast.
Yep. Geography. Fun, kids.
Yeah. That game in 2 weeks is going to be pretty tough. So that'll probably be their biggest home game of the year.
Yeah, because they only got SMU once, right?
I believe so. Yeah, they only got SMU once, and that was in the middle of January. So, like, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so do we just want to move on to the SMU game? I mean, you got any other pressing points you want to make about the Knights and that kind of disappointing performance?
Not per se, but it does fold into SMU. Because, like, out of the last three games, we've seen UC throw up offensive clunkers twice. Some of that was just because of how Tulsa played, but some of it was how UCF played. But given Tulsa's last two results of getting absolutely murdered, that game at Tulsa wasn't really speaking a ton. And when you turn to SMU, they keep on like rolling everybody. They do play, I guess they're playing now against Temple as we record this on Thursday night. But they continue to roll, and that game is going to be incredibly interesting, to say the least. But and currently, unless like something happens with SMU, somebody gets hurt, I kind of think UC could be walking into their first league loss.
I mean, it's looking that way, unless something changes pretty drastically, or they get the first, you know, they need long-term trends to change. That's KJ, Jacob Evans, and Troy just generally underwhelming. Or they need Jerron Cumberland to play well in a road game for the first time in his career. That'd be pretty helpful. I mean, like it's looking like it's going to take something like that to get this done in Moody. I mean, like they just don't lose there. You see, I think they have, what, three conference losses at home in the last 2 or 3 years? UC had one of them.
Yeah, like on average, they've been losing like once a year at home. Which is pretty impressive.
And yeah,
hey, go ahead.
No, it's like if you lose once at home, guess what? You're in contention for the league title every year.
And they've been in contention for the league title every year, except I think maybe the first year. And that was just the only year they... Well, I guess it was, they didn't make the tournament last year, but they definitely would have. It's the only year they clearly didn't make the tournament. Even then, they were like a bubble team. Who many thought should have gotten in anyway? That's neither here nor there. This SMU team is pretty much just the same guys that played last time against UC. And that was a game that really came down to one shot rimming out and SMU missing the putback. That was the best offensive effort we've seen against UC, and one of UC's better offensive efforts on the other end. A huge games for Clark and Copain. And Kyle Washington had a solid game. So you have to hope, like, whatever is happening with Gary Clark, where he's not really consistently engaging offensively, that he steps it up for the SMU game.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is no one on SMU's roster who can really guard it. Like, if you run down their list, I mean, you might say Ben Moore, but he's probably got a guy guard Kyle because he's their best defender. Semi doesn't really have any interest in playing defense that I've seen. He's kind of a passive participant on defense.
I'm pretty sure they just stuck him on Evans the first time.
I think that's right.
Or they put him on Evans or Kyle, or Kevin Johnson.
Either way, they just tried to hide him.
Definitely.
And you can't let him get away with that. Like, UC has to be much more diligent in this game about making their guys, talking primarily about Semi, Shake, and Ben Moore, roughly their big three. I mean, you could say switch Brown and Ben Moore, Sterling Brown and Ben Moore, whatever. You're arguing over roughly equivalent players at the third spot. But you need to make those guys work on defense. You need to put them in the action. You need to run their guys through countless screens just to make them work on that end of the court. Like, you need to employ the Cavs' final strategy of putting Steph Curry in the action every time just to make him tired and just to hit him as many times as possible. Now, obviously, you're not playing a seven-game series, but, I mean, these guys all play 35 minutes a game. Like, any minute they can buy not having to really put an effort on the defensive end is a wasted minute, as far as UC is concerned. Like, they have the better depth. They have way more players. They have way more competent players. You have to play this game at a pace where that shows. You can't let SMU control the pace, because if they do, and this is where I'm concerned, because for most of this rivalry, it's been a battle of paces, where UC is trying to exert their will on SMU, where SMU wanted to play fast because that was the pace that Nick Moore was more comfortable at, and they had more guys then, and they were just kind of better off playing like that. That's not this team. They're much better at a slower pace, and they know it, and they don't really let anybody speed them up. Well, UC has to try to speed them up. Now, if that doesn't take and it doesn't work, fine. Beat them on their terms. But you have to try to make this game as easy as possible for your guys. You have to try to get easy buckets. You have to try to get Jacob Evans, Troy, and, you know, the guards some easy runs to the rim in transition. And I know that's a new concept, you know, transition buckets, but, I mean, this is the kind of team where you have to try that because they are just so paper thin. Like, they have six guys, and they're all really good, but they only have six guys.
Yeah, and flipping it to the SMU offense, like, we all know how well they execute. And they do, like, the same thing that you were talking about. They do, like, almost anything they can to exploit you defensively. Like, they'll do anything to get, like, Milton on a big or Sterling Brown in a mismatch, especially Owale. Like, he's really good, and he can take anybody anywhere. And if you put a big on him, he can just pull up from three. Like that, and they never turn the ball over, which is kind of insane when they don't really have a... They have one point guard, and it's Shake Milton, and that's it. Like, they're kind
and
of...
He's not even a point guard. He's just the only ball handler, because there are literally zero other ball handlers on the roster.
But and then at the same time, there's really no black holes on their roster, because you mentioned, just like pretty much everybody they played outside of Emegwu, like all played pretty well. Like, Ben Moore had killed UC on the offensive glass. Sterling Brown had 11 rebounds and 20 points. Like, it's a really tough team to match up against. And they shoot a ton of threes, and they make a lot of them. That was one of the things UC did the first time, where Copain hit 5 of 8 from 3, and UC as a team hit 12 of 26. Something you have to take advantage of. You have to get your shots up when you can. So they're pretty much the second best team after UC. And if you averaged out their offense and defense, the teams are almost equal in the ratings. So, it's a real toss-up, and given that it's at Moody, which is a really tough place to play, I think you do have to give SMU a bit of an edge. It'll be the first time since December UC's going to be an underdog.
Yeah, and they as well they should be. SMU has played outstanding basketball, you know, for a very prolonged, like, we're going on 6 weeks of just A-plus basketball at this point from SMU. Yeah, the key to this game is going to be, as it has so often been since UC has gone to this zone-based defense for the most part, is they're going to have to rebound. And they're going to have to strike a balance between committing guys to rebound while also trying to push the tempo and running. But it's kind of a catch-22, because if you do that, that means Jacob Evans staying back to rebound, Kevin Johnson staying back to rebound, Jerron Cumberland staying back to rebound. They're not leaking out. They're not trying to get easy buckets. So it's like you either try to kill off possessions or you gamble trying to just rebound with your two posts and hoping that you can get, you know, a couple quick breaks to beat their defense before they set. I mean, like, it's just, it's a tough, I mean, that's really a tough ask. Like, just being frank, it's just going to be a very hard thing for them to pull off. But I firmly believe that to beat SMU, you have to speed them up. You have to make them uncomfortable. If you let them walk the ball up without pressure the entire game, you know, that's not really doing yourself or, you know, any favors.
And this game, it'll be interesting to see what, like, where the Nysia Brooks absence plays in. In the first meeting, I believe he did get some run, and that was one of the games where Kyle Washington only played 28 minutes. So, like, you do wonder, like, what do. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we've seen way more Quadri Moore in the last three or four games than I think anybody's really comfortable with. Trey Scott has been pretty much relegated to ninth man status.
And Trey Scott played 15 minutes of the first game. So that would be a pretty big switch.
Yeah, I can't foresee him playing more than 10. Like, it's going to take a lot of fouls to get him over 10 minutes.
Yeah, definitely. At the same time, Cumberland only played 11 minutes that game.
That's definitely not going to... He's going to play like 25.
Yeah, that game was the last time he played like that few minutes. The 16 against Tulane, 19 against UCF. And those are the only games he's played under 20 minutes. Been pretty much in league play.
Yeah, and the UCF game was weird. I thought that was a good opportunity for him to kind of go off a little bit, but for whatever reason, it just didn't quite happen. Like, that game and the Tulsa game, it's just like he had a rough couple early possessions, and he just kind of was timid from that point on. And you can't have that at this point in the season. Like, he's too important a player for this team. He does too much off the bench in terms of providing the scoring punch. Like, he is the only bench scoring. So he's got to go in with the attitude that he's putting up shots, and good shots or bad shots, I honestly really don't care. He just needs to have that mentality. I mean, with him, it's so much about confidence. If his confidence is high, he starts feeling himself a little bit. He's incredible to watch. And he's a fucking load for basically anybody to handle. I mean, like, if he gets shoulder to shoulder with you, it's over. You're fouling him or he's making it at the hoop. I mean, those are the two outcomes to that play. There's really no third way.
I think one of the biggest things with him is, like, he just doesn't get to the line on the road. He had 5 attempts at Tulsa. That's skating back. Didn't get to the line at all against Tulane. Was 2 of 3 against East Carolina. Didn't attempt 1 at Houston. And was 0 of 1 against Temple. Like, that's the biggest difference in his game. Like, as you mentioned, like, once his confidence gets going, like, he's impossible to stop. He had a monster game against UConn. Like, 15 points. And that was sandwiched between 3 points and 4 points. Which was preceded by 26 and 15.
Yeah.
Both at home.
Well, key point there. Yeah, I mean, like, the Tulsa game was really interesting because, as you mentioned, he got to the line 5 times. And he got to the line 5 times in, like, 2 minutes. And then he seemingly didn't take a shot after that. I mean, you can't have that. He can't be that silent. He can't play, you know, he can't play, let's put it this way, he can't play 20 minutes and have 3 shots. Just can't have it. Like, you gotta, like, this is your role. This is what you have to do. You're no longer a freshman. This is no time to be timid. This is the biggest game of the year. You win this, the conference is over. You are a conference champ as a freshman. And you played a big role. Like, this is your time, dude. Just time to show it. Like, we know how good you can be. Like, this dude's going to be an all-conference player multiple years. Like, he's that freaking good.
He'll probably be all-conference selection next season, at least on one of the teams.
Second team at worst.
Not to pick on Cumberland, but in the neutral and away games this season, guess how many points he scored combined?
See, this is funny that you asked me this question when I have his player page up. Do you want me to count on air?
No, it's 26. His career high against South Florida was matched by all of his road games. Like, you definitely need him to play better. And, like, there's, like, as you mentioned, there's no bigger game than this. He's really got to bring it. And, like, they all do, but, like, as you mentioned, he's got to be the guy to score off the bench. So they've really gotten, like, nothing from their bench lately.
Well, yeah, and it's not just that they need him to score off the bench. They need scoring, period, from the perimeter. With the way Evans, Troy, and KJ are playing of late, like, they just need a scoring punch from the outside. And who, like, he's the last option. He is the only other guy in line. So, like, if he doesn't do it, like, you know, Gary and Kyle are amazing players, but you're not making a run in March. Pounding, like, requiring you to get, like, 15 post touches a game. 15 clean post touches a game. Like, you're just not doing it. It's not happening. The defenses are too good. You're too well scouted. Everybody knows your tendencies. It's just not going to work unless you get the perfect matchups, unless you get teams that have nobody bigger than 6'5".
Which, like, if you're going to end up in the territory UC wants to end up, that's just not going to happen. Because you're going to play, well, you'll get that in maybe round one, depending on what mid-major team you draw. But then, like, in the second round, if you're a 3 or 4 or 5 seed, you're definitely playing a power conference team in the second
round. You're playing a power conference, you're playing a real team. You're playing a team that's seeded 10th that is probably, like, 30th in KenPom.
Yeah, or if you don't play a power conference team, you're playing, like, Wichita State, or Clemson, or Indiana. Like, somebody who's got size and underachieving. But you know, like, they have a ton of talent. Like, and you can't afford offense like this unless you want to get bounced early. Which, that's, like, what I'm looking forward to. Like, you can, like, play poorly in February, and I'll be okay if they play. Like, if they start playing better a month from now, and just don't lose again after March 5th, which would be ideal.
Yeah. And I mean, like, this is, I'm sure you saw the tweet earlier today mentioning the last time that UC went into SMU at this stage of the season on a 15-game winning streak. It was like 3 years ago. And they were 22-2. And that team didn't do so hot in the tournament.
Team was 22-2 and finished 27-7.
Yeah. So the concern is this just the doldrums of conference play, or is this an actual slippage? And I was like, this is the shitty part about playing at this conference. It's impossible to tell.
They kind of like
you cannot show up for half of these games, play terribly, and still win by 10.
Because, like, you look, but just take that year, the 2014 season, 2013-2014. That league was almost the same. Like, Memphis was good. Or Memphis was okay. SMU, as we mentioned, was a bubble team. But you had Cincinnati, Louisville, UConn. Like, clear class of the league. And, like, UC rolled through everybody, as you mentioned, until they got to SMU. And then they ended up sharing the league title as they kind of stumbled down the stretch. They lost to SMU, lost to Louisville, lost to UConn. And then they got bounced in the conference tournament and lost to Harvard. Like, their fall,
yeah, I mean,
like, that year it was pretty tough. And, like, I don't think they're, like, on that same trajectory where they could stumble that badly, at least in league where they would lose the league title. So the league is a lot worse. But, like, I don't think they're so much, like, better than some of these other teams where if they kept playing this poorly offensively that they could get bounced in the first round.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, if you play this badly on offense, you know, we've A constant theme of this podcast to anyone who's listened for a long time, I apologize for rehashing it for the hopefully new listeners. Hi. When you get to March, when it's one and done, you just need more variability. To quote Zach Lowe, you just need more stuff. Like, you need to be able to do more things than just pound the ball for 20 seconds at the top of the key looking for a post duck in. Like, you need to do more than that. And this team has shown that they are capable of way more than that. They've shown against good teams that they are capable of more than that. But ever since the Xavier game, they've kind of lost the plot a bit. Like, they're not doing the things that they were doing well before. They're not sharing the ball nearly as well. The assist rate's down. The turnovers are up fractionally. But when you play as low a possession game as UC does, and when the turnovers were so frickin' low to begin with anyways, a minor uptick, like, it's a real problem. It's really noticeable.
Especially when you stopped getting to the free throw line.
Just take some of that variability away. And it's looking increasingly likely that UC is going to go into March looking like the same UC team that's been to the last six tournaments with better players, but playing the exact same way.
Because, like, on top of that, like, your free throw rate has gone from over 30%, I think over 30%, 32% in the non-conference to 28.7 in league play. Like, they've just been getting to the foul line less and less and less and relying more and more on three-point shots. And we saw it against Tulsa, and we saw it against UCF. Like, when they don't go in like they did against UConn, like, this offense is kind of, like, stagnant. And they go through long patches where they can't score. And their defense is good enough to shut a lot of these teams down. Like, Tulsa, they shut down completely. UCF was kind of lucky to break 50. And the only reason UConn lost by 14 is because UC played, like, unbelievably terrible defense late after playing so well. Like, the first 30 minutes, they played great defense, great offense. Then they just stopped playing defense against UConn. But that wasn't the point. The point is, like, they have to start rounding it back into form on offense. And it's like they have a great team looking them dead in the eye that wants to knock them off.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like, the comparison with the 2014 team is really interesting to me for a couple different reasons. The statistical profile in terms of where the shots came from, how they got them, is very similar. The biggest difference is this team has way better post players, so they get more two-point attempts are up, but they don't get more points from two-point attempts relative to that team, because obviously they're 2 points, they're not worth as much as a three. But that SK team, they had SK. And when all else failed, they reverted to SK, Justin Jackson, pick and roll. You know, Kilpatrick's either getting a bucket, he's getting a shot, or he's getting fouled. Like, the free throw rate of that team was insane because the last 5 minutes of every game was the same. SK gets the ball, SK goes to the hole, he probably gets fouled, he might make a shot. But that was very effective because he shot, 85% from the line. So they could generate points that way. This team doesn't because they don't have... It's not that they don't have guys who do that. It's that they don't have guys whose instinct is to make that play. You know, Troy can do that whenever he wants. Cumberland can do that whenever they want. But is their instinct automatically to do that? I mean, this is year four of Troy. I think we can say pretty conclusively that it's not. And Cumberland's only a freshman. Like, he can get there. I have no doubts about that. But expecting that level of maturity and understanding of tactics is... It's asking a lot of a freshman, you know?
Yeah, and especially since his biggest problem has been his just overall consistency offensively and defensively. That's like, I think that's kind of definitely in his head too. Like, if some of these young guys mess up on defense, they're out of the game. Like, no questions asked. Like, Mick, when Cumberland, I think it was Cumberland, blew a defense that gave a UConn a lob, Mick looked at Cumberland like the meanest I've ever seen a person look at another person. And then Cumberland was on the bench. But it was kind of funny. But that stuff happens where he's just like, goodbye, you're not playing the next, like, 10 minutes. And he didn't. He came back in the game and had a really good game.
And I get Mick's frustration, but at the same time, you got to realize that, like, this dude is your future. Like, yeah, I get it. Like, freshmen make mistakes. You're playing a freshman. He's going to make mistakes. That's built into what you're doing. You have to go in assuming that he's going to fuck up a couple times a game in big ways. But what he does well more than makes up for that. But, you know, one mistake, he's out. Justin Jennifer, he makes one bad rotation, gone. He makes one lazy pass, gone. It's just like, I mean, at a certain point, I get it. But it's like, these are the guys you're going to be having running your team next year.
It's like Justin Jennifer guarded the wrong guy on the inbound against Tulsa and then didn't play the rest of the game.
Yeah, it's just like, I get it, but it's, at the same time, it's like, you have to develop these guys. And, like, how are they going to develop? Like, how is, really, like, honestly, how is Justin Jennifer developing this year? And don't tell me that playing with Troy Copain is a great learning experience. I mean, it is, yeah, but you know what else is a great learning experience? Playing meaningful minutes.
Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. Because he's been got a kind of solid run the last couple of games. And I think it's mostly because of his three-point shooting. Like, something we really harped on was the three-point shooting of some of these guys starting to go in the tank. And, like, Jennifer's, like, the one guy where he's not consistent. But, like, he can knock them down. Like, on the year, it's 38%. And he hit 2 of 3 against UCF. He had a couple against South Florida as well. And I think that's kind of encouraging. At least they're starting to run him and Troy in the backcourt more.
Which is something they should have been doing. This is something you should be doing from day one, because you know what the best teams in college basketball this year all have in common, with the exception of UCLA? They all essentially play 2-point guards. They might not be labeled as point guards, but they have 2-point guards. You know, like, Kentucky is the example that comes to mind every time. Yeah, you know, Fox and Monk, those are two, I mean, they'll probably both play point guard in the NBA, even though they're kind of tweeners. But that's their natural position, and it just makes everything easier. Having two capable ball handlers, two good decision makers on the floor at the same time, it's invaluable.
Yeah, and even then they play Briscoe at point two.
Yeah, and like, for most of the year, the second point guard has been Gary Clark. He can do it, capable. Like, he had a string of games there where he was posting offensive ratings over, you know, 120, taking like 3 shots a game. Because he's a good, you know, he's a good playmaker. But is that the best use of him? Probably not. It all goes back to the central theme. You just have to be able to do more stuff. And you got to let your guys do stuff. Like that, and that's the other part of it. It's like, this team could play beautiful basketball. Like, they really can. Like, there are sequences where the ball is popping, it'll hit all 5 hands, and it'll result in a layup in about 5 seconds. But they come out of nowhere, and they're not repeated. They're like unicorns. You see them once every 4 games. It's like, oh my god, what was that shooting star? Holy shit. That was phenomenal. How do we do that again? You know what they remind me of? It's like a a kid who's playing like Street Fighter. See, this is how old I am, people. Street Fighter's my go-to. Okay, it's like a 4 or 5 year old playing Street Fighter, and he comes up with some amazing combo and he knocks you the fuck out. But if you rematch it 5 times, he will never be able to make that same combo because he just doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know how to repeat it. He just made something amazing happen, and he has no idea how or why. That's those beautiful sequences of basketball that you see have once every couple games.
This is going to make me sound terrible, given your example. I did that in like Mortal Kombat once against one of my friends. Flawless victory to him. And then I never beat him again the rest of the day. It was insane.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, everybody's got that one. But you got, like, consistency.
This was years ago. It wasn't yesterday.
repeat the feat, you know?
Yeah, so where do you stand on SMU? Are they going to win, or are they going to lose?
I'm going into this expecting them to lose. I would not be shocked if they won, though. Because, like, they have real advantages in the post. They have real advantages on the wing, too. If Evans and Cumberland are playing to their potential, and if Cumberland plays a road game for once. Like it's really going to take some... If everybody plays to norms, given the home court advantage, SMU wins. Like, they need something out of the ordinary, and the most likely candidate for that is Cumberland.
I think we both feel the same way. We're both leaning towards SMU. Like, KenPom has it 66-34. That seems about right. I can't really argue too much against that. Like, it's entirely plausible they beat SMU. Like, it was a one-possession game last year with mostly these same Bearcats. And it's going to come down to the wire. We know that for sure. Them and SMU, you know you're going to see a hotly contested game.
Yeah, it always is.
Like, when you come to the final 5 minutes, it's going to be... Somebody may be trailing by 5, but you know what you're going to be in for one.
Well, this is the kind of game where you can skip the first 35 minutes and tune in for the last 5 and just know exactly where you are. It's like, oh, this is familiar. I'm well acquainted with these surroundings. I don't know the outcome, but I'm familiar with what's happening.
My biggest concern in this game is something I noticed SMU doing a lot as I've watched them play lately, is they end the half extremely strong. Like, as they closed out Tulsa, they put like an 8-0 run down, I think, something like that, at the end of the half on Tulsa. That went from a close game to kind of a blowout. And against UC got off to that gigantic lead against SMU. Then SMU made a big run like at the end of the half. They cut the lead to like something manageable. So like, that's my biggest concern, especially at Moody, where that place is kind of like always crazy. At least for a big game, that place is like always crazy.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that's the toughest road environment in the conference at this point. Yeah. Now, like, if UConn was really rocking and they actually decided to play their games at Gamble, like all their fans want, that would be in the conversation. But because they decided to play all their games in Hartford for money reasons, it's kind of soulless there. And UC for a big game is great, but you're dealing with the fact that, you know, it's an arena not built for basketball for another year anyways.
And like one of the major concerns for some of the games is the red sweaters aren't the loudest people in the world.
No, and they fuck up whiteouts and blackouts and all the fun stuff we try to do,
which are hard enough as is. Especially, like, I don't know how those are so hard for UC fans. They just need to start passing out shirts. Just get over it. Like, Kroger donate like I don't know, like 5,000 shirts so people on TV can wear the same shirt and it doesn't look stupid.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Or you could direct the fine old gentleman sitting in the front couple rows to a spot where they can get white and black sweaters as well. Because, you know, we have an Under Armour contract, so shockingly, we have, like, stuff that you can buy. And I know it's not the same red sweater with the old C-Paul logo that you love, but you're fucking it up for the rest of us. That's all I'm saying. And thank you for your donation.
Good old Under Armour. Nothing bad has been happening for Under Armour lately.
Well, I haven't seen anything. Nope.
I do feel justified in not liking Under Armour jerseys with them firing their CEO for, in part because they have ugly merchandise in general. That just kind of made my day when I read that whenever it broke.
Yeah, it's been an interesting couple weeks for the old UA.
Yeah. We'll dive in more into the conference in the upcoming weeks as we look forward to the tournament. But as you mentioned, like, nobody close. Houston, Memphis, both 8-4, and the rest is garbage. Let's turn our attention to the football schedule, which was just released earlier on Thursday. From the looks of things, it looks like a pretty challenging schedule for Luke Fickle in year one. Start on a Thursday, like just like last year, against a garbage team. Then they hit Michigan, Miami University, and Navy in a really tough road trip, and we'll kind of find out how good this team is almost right off the bat. That's almost as tough a road trip as you can get, like back-to-back-to-back in early September.
Well, one of those is a pseudo-home game.
Very true.
But, well, I don't know. Maybe Miami went to a bowl game for the first time in 6 years, so they might have some fans there. Historically, nah, not so much. Yeah, I mean, like that, once again, we're going to know a lot about this team at the end of September. Because Michigan, Miami, Navy is a pretty tough three-game road trip. Yeah, like if they can get out of September 3-2, I'll be happy. If they get out 4-1, I'm ecstatic. And if they get out 2-3, we have a rebuilding project on our hands.
If they come out of September 2-3, the last game being Marshall at home, and Marshall was trash last year, that's kind of what, I don't know, I don't want to say I expect them to go 2-3, but that seems like the more mathematical possibility.
Oh, if you're playing the odds, that's the probabilities for sure.
Going to Michigan is almost definitely a loss.
That's an L.
Going to Navy, we already know when the Navy game is. It's on a 3:30 on a Saturday. Like, that's a really tough place to play, and I don't think too many teams have gone to Navy and won. So
yeah, and there's also the small factor of no UC team in living memory has played a true triple option team since I don't even want to talk about it. But 2004, Army was on an enormous like 40 game losing streak, and then they beat UC. Yeah, that was D'Antonio year one. So I really think that it's the last time they played an option team.
It has to be, because none pop up off the top of my head.
Like, I don't want to do the research live on air, but I'm fairly confident that it's been well over a decade since they played an option team of any sort. Unless you count peak Rich Rod, West Virginia. Which, technically, but, yeah, different.
Slightly. From there, UCF, SMU on a two-game homestand. The UCF game being the more interesting game. They should probably beat SMU. UCF, Probably they won't be favored to win the league, but I kind of think they'll be picked second in the conference, given how they finished last season. That's the game UC has lost the last 2 years, like the first home conference game. So
yeah, it's not gone well.
But that old coach is gone, so hopefully some of that has changed. Although getting at Navy and UCF your first two conference games is not really great.
Not ideal. Not ideal at all. Yeah, like this schedule is simultaneously difficult and manageable because it's not like they have. I mean, you're right. The toughest three game stretch is going to be Michigan, Miami, and Navy, just because Michigan and Navy are really good, and Miami's a rival. And Miami, like if there's anything that's been clear from the last 4 years, well, the Tuberville era of this rivalry is that Miami cares way more than UC did.
Yes. And the last game in Oxford, Miami had a great chance to win. Caden Moore had to lead a game-winning touchdown drive late.
The last three games in Oxford have been absolute dumpster fires.
Actually, there was the one back when they had, I guess, Brian Kelly's one of his trips to Oxford. They didn't even score a touchdown offensively.
Yeah. There was the Travis Kelce game that also went not so well. Yeah, like it's just they've not played well in Oxford despite having the away field advantage.
And as you mentioned, like Miami cares so much more about that game than UC did the last few seasons, especially. Like last season, it was so bad. I believe I even said on the podcast that I thought Miami would beat UC in the next 5 years. How well they played against UC. I can change that statement, but that game was going to be really tough. And we know they're going to be up for UC. And we don't really know what the Bearcats have. Like, that game of Michigan is going to be kind of interesting. In this sense. Because that'll be their first real game of the season. And then, like, Miami. Like, how do you come back from whatever happens against Michigan, which will probably be a blowout loss, and then to play that tough game that you don't really care about before you go on the road in league play? It's like probably one of the toughest places to win in the league against a style you don't really see, and a game like you can't really lose if you want to win the league title. It's kind of a tough start. A tough sandwich.
Yeah, it's definitely a rough start. But the finish is very, it's well cushioned.
Yeah. Let's jump to that. After UCF on October 28th, so far, like besides the Labor Day weekend start, all the games are on Saturday, including November 4th at Tulane. So you get to Temple on Friday, November 10th. Then they go to at East Carolina, end the season with the gift of UConn. So, very manageable down the stretch, especially the last four. You should, no matter how good or bad UC is, the last four games, they should go 3-1, at the very least.
3-1 would be a disappointment, honestly. Like, I have no expectations for Temple this year. I just think that highly of Matt Rhule. That's really what it comes down to. The new guy might be great. I don't know. But I know the old staff was. So, if you break it down into groups of three, groups of four, probably 2-2, 2-2, 3-1, get you to a bowl, right? Is my math right? Yeah, 7-5.
7-5, yeah.
I'd be good with that. For year one, I'd be good with that. But here's the thing about, like, I know this team is capable of way more than that, just based on talent. The coaching staff's a huge unknown. We don't know how it's going to come together. It seems that the players have bought in and that the staff is going to be better at, you know, maximizing the inherent potential in the guys that Tubbs assembled. But yeah, it's a huge unknown. Like, this team could go 3-9. It could go 9-3. Honestly, neither one would shock me.
Yeah, because like, given like Luke Fickell's one season, like, there's really no great way to get a read off of that. Besides, like, he didn't have a quarterback that year, and Ohio State just wasn't very good.
Yeah, like, and he didn't have a quarterback. They weren't very good. They were an extremely young team. And he literally found out, like, 3 months before. Say, so, hey, can you coach this year? Yeah, I'm coaching the defense. No, like, all of them. The whole group. I mean, you can't say no. Yeah, I mean, like, he was, to put it mildly, he was not put in a position to succeed. He has a better chance here. That's all I'll say.
Was there anything in the schedule that jumped out at you real quick, besides just like one bye week in the middle of the year between UCF and SMU?
Not really. I mean, like, this is... Honestly, this is one of the more balanced schedules that UC's gotten from the AAC in recent years, because usually they seem to go out of their way to get UC out of the conference race in the second week of September. And boy, have they succeeded.
And it kind of looks like they're trying again. Like, it's like if we played up the negative side, if they start like 1-3 in the league, do you think that would just be completely deflating for everyone, or do you think UC could bounce back from that? Because last year, clearly they could not bounce back from adversity. They won 4 games.
Yeah, like, they could not bounce back from adversity because, to a man, like, there was just no leadership to the team. And I get the argument that leadership is in, like, inherent internal thing in players and that they have to have it themselves and generate it themselves. I get it. Like, fine. I hear your argument. But there is something to be said for setting a tone of just general competence and sustainability and expectations, standards. You know? Like, all of us have jobs. All of us have bosses. And I'm pretty sure there is a standard of work that you are supposed to meet. Right? Like, that's a universal thing. We all have it. It didn't seem like anybody set any standards for that group of 105 players last year. It's like everybody, you know, they played like a team where the coaches just rolled the balls out and were like, all right, y'all go. You got this. Run around and do shit. I don't know.
And it seemed like once like they lost the team, not to say that team like was really lost, but just the general.
No, but they lost faith in the coaching staff very quickly, and yes, it was evident to everyone.
So, which was going to be my point, like the point where your senior leaders on the team were complaining about who your quarterback was, and anytime like your senior leaders are complaining to your coach about your quarterback, that's not a great situation by any means. And you kind of really, if like UC was a bigger program, that I think that would have been a lot more of like a scandalous thing. If that happened at like, I don't know, like Georgia, people would have been talking about that for weeks. But since it happened at UC, nobody really cared, because UC was already like 3-3 or whatever by that point. But like that definitely shouldn't happen this year.
And yeah, like,
let's hope they actually announce a quarterback before the season starts.
I would hope. And honestly, like, nothing against Gibson. I hope Ross Joe wins this job, because I think he has the skill set required for this offense, and I think he is just an incredibly talented quarterback. And I would have liked to seen what he could do with an offense designed around him last year. Zach Taylor was not capable of designing an offense to make anybody succeed last year. So,
except in the very last game of the season, somehow.
Yeah, because Tulsa's defense is woo, no bueno.
So, I'm sure we'll dive deeper into the schedule as we get closer. But, like, you can definitely see a bowl game. You can, I guess if you squint, you could probably see maybe an AAC East title. I don't know UCF's USF schedule, because I didn't look. But, like, at Navy, at USF, two of your first four league games, not really ideal. But if, like, they're good, they can handle it.
Well, yeah, like, if just based on, like, if my internal projections of who, like, the four of the five best teams in the AAC next year are, well, three of those four are on UC's schedule in the first four games. So, like I said, we'll know pretty soon, pretty quickly, whether or not they're good.
And, like, really, that's kind of what you want to happen. You don't want to wait till, like, middle of October to know. And, like, looking at USF's schedule, they play a really weird backloaded schedule.
So, well, they're the most. Of course they did. Of course they did. They are the most prominent team in the conference. They are gonna. They're gonna have all their big games late.
According to the ESPN schedule, they play Illinois on back-to-back days, which has to be something new.
That's dope. I didn't know college football did back-to-backs.
I don't know how they got them to agree to that one.
It's like the NBA. I wonder if they're going to rest their players.
They might. They play the October 14th non-conference game. What do they think this is, like the SEC or something?
Yeah, I mean, we played BYU in November. That was weird, too.
Don't bring up past history. Yeah, this was not my best podcast.
I don't think any of us are really proud about this. And there's only two of us on the pod. I'm sure Chris is just horrified every time he listens.
Yeah, well,
okay. Shut up, you're rambling. Yes, because you're not here to maintain the order, Chris.
Yeah, one day he'll be back on the podcast.
When he's better slept.
So, like 3 to 5 years.
Come on, he's got to get him on a schedule sooner than that, right?
Maybe.
We'll see.
You just put on some, like, Tulane basketball and try to sleep easily.
Knock them right out. But just got to make sure that there are no close-ups of Mike Dunleavy. Because that'll wake him right up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Don't want to wake that baby up. So no Mike Dunleavy.
Oh, yeah. So, sorry to his child. Enjoy your nightmares.
And I think that does it.